My work partner said to me at one point, I wish an investigative journalist would come and investigate this place.
Were you so ignored at that point? You're like, me too. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on a second. From First Look Media and Panoply, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kondabolu. The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
We'll explore why sometimes this democracy ain't so democratic. On today's show, we're going to discuss the very American thing of private prisons.
We are. I thought we were having our who is the best Aunt Viv debate.
You know, Ms. Banks, since you had that baby, there's something different about you.
Oh, no, we're going to do that, but I need to do a lot more research before that happens.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, hurry. Did you know that the U.S. accounts for roughly 5% of the world's population, but over 20% of the prisoner population?
The number of people in prison or parole or on probation exceeds the populations of Los Angeles and Chicago combined.
I did not know that, but I can't say I'm surprised given all the crimes and policy decisions that started putting more people behind bars, like the Rockefeller drug laws in the 70s in New York, and of course the three strike laws in the 90s, and essentially the whole war on drugs. Not the indie band. They're okay.
And you know what can make prison even worse? It's making them private, letting those prisons be run by corporations for profit. And so to get into some of these issues, we're talking with Mother Jones journalist Shane Bauer. He spent 4 months in one of these private prisons in Louisiana as a guard. And yes, this is the same Shane Bauer who was a prisoner in Iran with his wife and a friend of theirs back in 2009, 2011.
And now we see Shane Bauer and Josh Cazal. They've emerged. The families are cheering. They're so happy. They're running down the steps.
Oh, look at this. There they are.
So, you know, his life is hashtag not the best.
I don't like to admit that people are better than me, but this guy is better than me. We're going to hear about his time as a prison guard, how some of these private prisons operate, and what impact the presidential election could have on this issue.
All that and more on today's Politically Reactive. Also, Hari, I'm also better than you. Hari, it's our second episode of Politically Reactive.
I got to say, I'm excited, but I'm really surprised after the first episode.
What are you surprised about?
Well, you and I have a history of making things that are really good and exciting that then get cut a lot shorter than they need to be, like totally biased. So I just assumed this was going to be finished after the first episode.
Well, don't relax. We're only two episodes in. Totally biased with more than two episodes. This could go the same number of episodes Totally Biased did.
Well, I just hope this doesn't go daily.
You and me both, brother. You and me both. So I'm excited about today's episode. Last Friday on Twitter, Mother Jones sent out a tweet with this huge article that was written by journalist Shane Bauer about how he worked for 4 months at a prison in Louisiana. Two things I'm not big fans of, prison and the parts of Louisiana that aren't New Orleans.
This is the dude that that was held in an Iranian prison for 2 years, right? Because like him and his now wife were hiking in Iraqi Kurdistan and then they got captured. So this guy has perhaps the coolest life slash luckiest life slash unluckiest life slash most important life that we've come across in quite some time.
Yeah. This is a pretty big second episode. I was going to get, we kept saying coolest and luckiest. I was like, I don't know if you ask me, this sounds kind of like, that's what we hope to talk to him about because, I mean, you know, you get taken into an Iranian prison. That's not, you didn't choose that. But then to go be a prison guard in a prison in Louisiana, he chose that one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was that's where, and also, I have so many things to say. I think they're all jumbled in my head because I can't believe a human like this exists.
Yeah.
That he wrote in Mother Jones and not what I expected him to do, which was Huffington Post or perhaps.
Tumblr. I would have written the blog in the tears in my pillow. That's where I would have written the article. and Shane is here with us. I also can't believe that he decided to waste his time with us, but he's here in studio. Well, let's get him in the room. First of all, thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for having me. I'm excited.
I'll start with, so you had already been through this situation, we talked about this a little bit, mm-hmm. where you were a political prisoner in Iran.
Yeah.
And then you come out of that and you write a book, you co-write a book and with your wife. And then I feel like if it was me, if I'd gone through that situation, I would have pitched Mother Jones, can I be a travel reporter talking about the greatest beaches in the world? can I do all our resort reporting? Like, you know.
I mean, why not just go back to grad school and teach at that point? I mean, you already have the experience that makes you cool, professor. I mean, you don't need to push it anymore.
Yeah, like what made you decide to do this?
Well, I got out of prison 5 years ago, and I started as a journalist in the Middle East, and I kind of actually thought I would go back to the Middle East, and I got out, and shortly after I got out, I heard about a huge hunger strike that was happening in California over long-term solitary confinement, people that were spending 10, 20, 30 years in solitary confinement, and after having spent time in solitary myself, I just was kind of paying attention to it. I wasn't really ready to kind of jump back into my work yet, but I started looking into it and got pulled in and ended up writing about that. And, you know, I never have really decided, okay, I'm going to just keep writing about prison. But I just kind of got pulled into the U.S. prison system. It's vast. I mean, there's kind of no end, 2.3 million people behind bars. It's just this onion that kept unraveling. And I spent a few years kind of reporting on prisons and criminal justice and was kind of constantly coming up against a wall. It's really hard to get into prisons. It's hard to get information from prisons. We have all these great public records laws, but a lot of corrections departments just don't abide by them, and you can't get things from a lot of them without suing. And with private prisons, those laws often don't even apply because they're companies. And so these private companies have been running prisons for 30 plus years, and we don't know much about what happens inside them. So I thought, I'm going to try to get inside. So I applied.
This is a really basic question, but, why are private prisons a bad idea?
I mean, you have a basic contradiction with this, with private prisons. You know, these companies are traded on Wall Street. Obviously have a profit motive, and to turn a profit, you have to cut costs. The main way that they do that is through, paying lower wages, having less staff. And when you have less staff in a prison, there's a whole host of problems that result. So, you're basically stuck in the middle between this need to provide care and security and the need to turn a profit.
I mean, when did this start happening? When did prisons begin to be privatized? And what was the initial reason for it? Was it because there was the assumption there would be improved services, that capitalism and the market would handle it? I mean, how did this happen? How do we get here?
This happened in the 1980s. The company that I was investigating, the Corrections Corporation of America, they basically saw an opening because there were these new drug laws. There was people were serving longer sentences. More people were going to prison. Prisons were getting overcrowded. I mean, there was just a huge boom in the prison population, and the state couldn't handle it. So these companies kind of said, we can build and run prisons for you, and it'll cost you less money. So,
I mean, it seems to be crazy on a couple of levels that some company would be like, the minute you look at prison and go, I think we can make this run more efficiently, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But we can make money off of it. It seems like, whoa, 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 slow down. That's not what we should be in this for.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea to me seems antithetical to the idea of what prison should be, which is about rehab. That if
right.
The only way you're, I mean, it seems to me like this is true of schools too, that when you have more money in schools, the schools get better generally. And
right.
To me, it's like, therefore, if you spend more money on the prisoners, you're going to actually have healthier people.
Yeah, I mean, all this stuff costs money. Security costs money. Rehabilitative programs cost money. Healthcare costs money. Mental health care costs money. And these are all areas that I saw, there were drastic cutbacks in the prison.
Now, as a married man, and you've been through a very specific situation with your wife, mm-hmm. of being in Iran in a prison, how do you pitch this to your wife? how do you go? Like, I just did a show with CNN, United States of America, where I was like, I'm going to go hang out with the Klan. I didn't go, I'm going to infiltrate the Klan. I feel like my wife would have been like, no, you're not. So how do you, I mean, because there's a human cost to this on
right.
your side of things, of having gone through a very traumatic situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then now going to do this. Like, how did you guys talk about that?
Well, I mean, prison is a big part of our lives. I mean, we went through prison together. We both work on prisons. My wife has been spending the last couple of years writing a play about solitary confinement. So it's not as if it just kind of drops out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But yeah, me saying that I want to be a guard in a private prison wasn't a small thing.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, it's not, it doesn't drop out of nowhere, but it's still like a different level of what you're doing, writing articles from the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it wasn't an easy decision for us, but she supported it. I mean, she saw the value in it and that it was going to be important. She was coming back and forth. She spent some time in Louisiana there with me. She would kind of check up on me. And, you know, she told me after she had been gone and came back, and she said, you know, you're changing. You know, she could see it. I was becoming a guard, and she was concerned about that.
Hey, you even went so far as to grow a, would you grow a beard?
Yeah, Fu Manchu.
I love that you assume, like, this will help me blend in. This will hide my Bay Area-ness if I grow the Fu Manchu.
It just seemed like the ultimate cop facial hair.
How hard was it to get the job?
Not hard. I mean, I for one, I didn't think it was actually going to work out. I mean, I just went on the website and filled out an application. There's a CCA, you know, just has an application section on the website. I fill out an application truthfully using my name and my current employer, and basically just, you know, clicked a handful of boxes next to some prisons that I wanted to apply to. And a week or two later, I was getting calls back from almost all of them wanting interviews. The interviews were kind of like what you would expect from a McDonald's or Walmart. It was like, you know,
can you be here?
Yeah.
Are you available? Yeah.
I mean, they never asked me anything about why I wanted to work in a prison, anything about my job history. You know, it's kind of like if you're told to go to a seminar you don't want to go to, what would you do? When was the last time you had a conflict and how did you deal with that? There was one question that had to do with prison, and it was, what is your idea of customer service and how does it apply to inmates?
Oh, my God.
Customer service.
I mean, even the conflict question's absurd. Like, how did you deal with the last conflict? Well, the last conflict, we talked it up, but the one before, I killed a guy. Like, it's very specifically worded in order to make it as easy as possible.
It was almost, some of these interviews were almost sales pitches. I mean, the one for Louisiana, when I spoke to the head of HR, you know, it's a $9 an hour job. She knows I'm calling from California. Ooh. She's trying to sell me this job. And she asked me if I like to hunt and fish. And I told her that, you know, I like to fish sometimes. And she asked if I liked squirrel hunting, because a lot of people in the area like to squirrel hunt.
So since you won't be able to afford food, you can kill and eat all the squirrels you want. Were you prepared to lie? Like, you didn't have to lie. Had you thought of, like, things you would say to lie to get in? Or were you going to just tell the truth and see what happened?
No, actually, I mean, kind of a ground rule was that I would never lie. Okay. So I, you know, was prepared if they, you know, Googled me, mm-hmm. which I thought was a distinct possibility. Then,
which apparently wasn't.
I would have to deal with that. You know, if they asked me if I was a journalist, I would say yes. And, you know, when I was there, I would just kind of, I wouldn't talk about myself that much.
You didn't show up every day going, did you guys see what Mother Jones wrote yesterday? Man, you weren't sharing a lot of Mother Jones articles on your Facebook page. Man, they are killing it with the left of journalism. They're really taking down the prison industrial complex over at Mother Jones. Anybody share that article?
How big is a corporation like this, and how do they make money? Like, what is the act? Like, what is the product? What is it that they're getting? How do they get it?
Well, CCA brings in $1.9 billion in revenue a year. They run over 60 prisons. They have stock on Wall Street. So they are making money from a combination of investment and payments from the state or the federal government. At Wynn, the state was paying $34 per inmate per day.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
Whoa. Did you hear that? $34. $34 is what an inmate at this prison is worth to the corporation who runs the prison. That's nothing. That's not even a pair of jeans. Okay, maybe that's like a crappy pair of jeans, like a Ross Dress for Less pair of jeans. And if you rip a pair of $34 jeans, you don't get them repaired. You throw them away. And that's what they're doing to the inmates in this prison when they get hurt or sick. They just throw them away. And think about that. If the prison sees you as $34 and you come up and say, hey, can I have a Band-Aid? They go, no, because then you're worth $33.50. We ain't giving you no Band-Aid.
But, you know, this is part of the issue because, you know, if you're making $34 per person per day and that person, you know, say has gangrene, like a person that I met there, and he needs to go to the hospital, a hospital trip costs a lot of money. I mean, that's going to cost a lot more than what they're making for that person. So I saw a lot of people who were making repeated requests to go to the hospital. This one guy, you know, was not sleeping because he was in so much pain. His feet were turning black, and he had to get his legs amputated eventually. I mean, he eventually went to the hospital when it was like his legs were rotting.
It just seems to me that the problem here is that, because I think about like private schools versus public schools or private hospital versus public hospitals.
Right.
And generally in those institutions, the care is better, but it's because you're the customer, you're considered.
Right.
Where in prison, the customer is the stockholder.
Yeah, and it was actually weird in training that one of the trainers would refer to the inmates as customers, and I never really got that logic.
Yeah, no.
I don't think they were paying to paying anybody to be in there.
No, they're basically like the McNuggets. And every now and again you eat one of those weird McNuggets and you just go, we can't sell this one, but it's not, they're not being treated as individuals.
How violent was it on a day-to-day basis?
There was a lot of violence, a lot more than I expected. I saw stabbings right in front of me, and we were trained, actually. My first full day of training, the trainer asked us, you know, what would you do if you saw two prisoners stabbing each other? And, you know, one person said, I'd break it up. You know, there were a couple of guesses. And then he basically told us, our job is to tell them to stop. So we see two people stabbing each other. We say, stop fighting. And he said, you know, we are not going to pay you enough to get in the middle of it. Our job is to tell them to stop, call for backup. And he said, if them fools want to cut each other, happy cutting. You know, and we don't have any weapons. We just have a radio, you know. So I would see people stabbing each other, and there's nothing that can be done. I mean, it's me and one other guard who's over 60 years old. There was very little security staff. I mean, there were days that I came in to the morning meeting and the total number of guards there were, you know, 24, 25 guards for 1,500 inmates. So I would be working in a unit with 350 prisoners with one other floor officer.
Well, this is something I thought was so amazing. When I found out you didn't have a weapon, like you didn't have a gun.
No, not.
Did you have a nightstick?
No, nothing. No billy gun.
You had a radio.
I had a radio. And they only got
radios. No pepper
radios.
Spray, too, right?
No. And they only got radios shortly before I started working there. So for most of this prison's existence since the 90s, the guards didn't even have radios.
I mean, I don't understand how your guard. I mean, first of all, I'm not a
right.
weapon person or a gun person.
Yeah.
But I feel like if I was going to be put in charge of guarding a prison, I'd be like, can I have one of those guns? can I have a stick of some sort? I just feel like, how do you maintain any authority when, one, you're not getting paid a living wage, and two, you don't have anything to do other than say, hey, guys, stop doing that?
I mean, you don't. There are certain ways that I had more power. I had this kind of power of the system where if somebody did something, you know, they might get punished later. But there's other ways that prisoners had more power than me. So it's like you're just one more person in this mess of hundreds of people that are trying to kind of figure out this complicated web of power and where you stand in it and how to navigate it.
What happened during those 4 months? Like, mentally, how did you change? Did you get desensitized?
Yeah, because you talk about the Stanford Prison Experiment in the article.
Yeah.
Did you feel yourself having those same changes?
Hold up. Wait a minute.
So the Stanford Prison Experiment was an infamous psychological experiment conducted in 1971 by Stanford psychology professor Philip Zimbardo. And it documented the psychological effects of being a prisoner or being a prison guard. And the participants in the experiment were assigned to roles. Some were inmates, some were guards. And what happened was things started out slow, but very quickly over the course of a few days, the guards started to psychologically and physically abuse the inmates, and they had to shut the whole thing down.
Yeah, I mean, it was strange because, you know, I took this job basically because it was the only way I could get inside. It was kind of a means, you know, and at first, especially when I was going through training, I felt like I was this journalist with a guard suit on, but I quickly became more, you know, a guard, and my days were occupied with the stresses of being a guard, and I saw myself change really quickly and kind of harden, and there were times that I just really lost it inside, you know, and kind of went off on prisoners. And it was this kind of schizophrenic dynamic where, you know, I would be inside and I would just be completely focused on what was happening in front of me for 12 hours. And then I would go home and it was kind of, I would be ashamed sometimes. I mean, it would be like, what is happening to me and how can I be such a different person? But even though I was aware of it, I couldn't stop it. I mean, it was just like, I didn't know, I was constantly trying to figure out how else to do it and I couldn't.
I mean, as a former prisoner, as somebody who'd been through this whole thing in Iran a few years previous, what was it like? How weird was it to be the one who was in power in that situation? The roles were reversed.
It was really weird. I mean, I was always wanting to say to the prisoners, you know, I've been locked up, to kind of like, you know, justify it or something. There was one time in particular I think of where the prison was on lockdown. We were having to distribute food to the prisoners because they couldn't leave their dorms. And I was pushing a food cart and somebody took an extra tray off the cart. And I just kind of automatically just start shouting at this guy. And one of the most intense moments when I was in prison in Iran was when my friend Josh took an extra tray off the food cart and the guard flipped out on him.
Oh.
And I almost got my ass beat for that. And
wait, in Iran? Or
in Iran.
Okay.
In Iran. Because, you know, he took Josh away. I was like, I didn't know what was happening with Josh. And I kind of, you know, got really worried. And I was causing a ruckus, banging on the door. And this guy came in and was like, shut the hell up. And he had a billy club. And so there was that moment when I yell at this guy that I'm like, whoa, here I am, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take much to kind of switch over.
How do you then segue out of that back to like back here in the Bay Area? Like, how do you then, you know, come back? Like, you, because you were there for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And how long were you planning on being there? Because I know you left sort of in a hurry.
I mean, there was no plan. It was kind of just like, I'll be there as long as...
Until the heat hits.
Yeah, I mean, just until it seems like it's done. And I think
it's funny, there's some alternate reality where you've been there for like 5 years, like, well, I'm actually moving up. And
Well, actually, it didn't take... it wouldn't have taken 5 years because before it all kind of came apart, about 2.5 months into the job, I had been picked for promotion. So
oh my God.
I was actually deciding, you know, I was really tired of the job and just, I was really seeing the kind of psychological toll it was taking on me. And
yeah.
It really seemed like it was time to leave. But I got offered this promotion and I thought, you know, should I follow this, see where that goes?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's the line someday. You're like, honey, they're making me the CEO. I'm going to make $3 million a year. I know it's bad, but in Louisiana, $3 million buys a lot of house. It occurs to me, I had a lot of retail jobs before comedy kicked in mm-hmm. 6 months ago. And like it was the same thing where it's like I would get promotions just because I was on time and I wasn't surly.
Yeah, no, basically because I did the bare minimum, I was getting, you know, offered a promotion within 2.5 months.
Yeah, because you're like, that guy's on time and he hasn't punched anybody yet.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's literally the same way you get promoted at McDonald's.
Right.
Like a lot of the employees aren't on time because they're not being paid enough to be on time. But then the few people who are on time suddenly are the district manager within a few months.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, can you get rid of private prisons? And I ask that because obviously in this country we need a better healthcare system. And when we were in the debate for healthcare, there was this idea that, no, the state cannot provide this. That's socialist. You're destroying an industry by doing this. And if like would we hear those same arguments? You're destroying an industry. You're taking jobs away from small towns where these prisons are. Like, can you actually close down private prisons? Can you actually hand them over to the state altogether?
I mean, I'm sure that we would be hearing those arguments, especially from the lobbyists of CCA and GEO. But you know, there's the question of you know, handing the prisons over to the state, and there's really.
Yeah, because the state isn't actually doing that good job with the prisons either.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I feel like we're sort of skipping that part of the argument,
too.
It's not like, I mean, I went to San Quentin for 4 days, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of good rehab programs,
right.
But they're still not letting a lot of those people out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give the impression that this is...
This is not an ad for public prisons.
No, it's not. But it's just, you know, there's a particular set of issues with private prisons and the conditions with that, you know, that are impacted by this kind of profit motive. I mean, I think there is a lot of pushback from states right now, actually, including in Louisiana. I mean, the time that I was at Wynn, the state was really cracking down on CCA. And actually, I mean, right before we shipped off this story, the Department of Corrections sent us copies of his correspondences with CCA. And it seemed like it was kind of, you know, they wanted to make sure that I knew that they were after CCA too. and they, I mean, a lot of, basically corroborated all of the issues that I dealt with in the story. They even, I didn't know this, but they pointed out that CCA was charging prisoners for state-issued toilet paper and toothpaste.
Oh,
they were charging them to clip their fingernails. I mean.
Oh, wow. It's so what we're saying is capitalism is the worst. I feel like that. I mean, I'm a fan of having money, but it feels like when capitalism runs everything,
right,
it destroys everything.
Yeah, and I mean, something that really surprised me about being there was how much, you know, I would expect that the prisoners would not be into this, and they weren't, but also the guards weren't. I mean, there was a lot of in a sense, kind of camaraderie between the guards and prisoners sometimes around the sense of being screwed by the company. and, you know, there was my work partner said to me at one point, I wish an investigative journalist would come and investigate this place.
Were you so inured at that point? You're like, me too. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on a second. Tie this into our current political landscape we mm-hmm. have here. Like, Obama is the first president to visit a federal prison.
Yep.
He's the first. He commuted like 46 people for nonviolent mm-hmm. offenses, commuted their sentences. Also, a part of this to me, I can't take away from it, like minimum wage need to be hiked up, because the fact that you could be paid somebody $9 to be a prison guard seems crazy to me.
Yeah.
So looking forward, we have a few choices for president. Like, do you look at any of these candidates and go, I feel like this president knows that we need to do some major prison reform in this country?
As far as the presidential situation, both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have promised that if they were elected, they would abolish private prisons. Now, you know, I'm not going to say that we happen to have a president that also said he was going to abolish, close another prison, Guantanamo, and that hasn't happened yet. But,
yes.
You know, but this is, you know, it's significant. I mean, it's never been said before. And it's a time right now where there is bipartisan support for criminal justice reform. You know, I think this is a time that the issue of not just private prisons, but the vast prison population that we have is really getting looked at. And a lot of people are trying to think of ways to reduce it. But just to touch on the minimum wage issue, there was a moment when I was working at Wynn where I came in the morning and was, you know, walking towards my unit with my work partner. And he said, did you hear about that Walmart raised its wages around the country? And it was kind of like this moment that was like, okay, is everyone going to bail?
I feel the same way with this as I feel about TSA. That a lot of people have the prison guard job and the mm-hmm. TSA job just didn't get a call back from Walmart.
Right, right.
And it seems to me these should be two different tracks of jobs.
Yeah, no, there was actually one guy who, he was straight out of high school, and he said to me, you know, he basically put in an application at McDonald's and Walmart, and they didn't call back. So the only job he'd had before this was mowing lawns. This is his
wow.
first job.
There are comedians who are looking for day jobs who are already applying.
Exactly. That. They're going to be filled with comedians like, I can work 12 hours, then go do some sets. All right. The last question we'll ask, and then we'll let you go because mm-hmm. you have many more interviews to do, is, I mean, to me, I'm just amazed after the thing that happened. I remember seeing interviews with you after, with your wife
yeah.
and your friend
uh-huh.
after you got back from Iran. I was like, I'm amazed they can walk and talk and put sentences together. And then you go through this, and I'm like, I'm amazed this dude can walk and talk and put sentences together. First of all, next, just go see how resorts are doing in the Bahamas is what I would recommend. But also, this is a weird question to ask, but welcome mm-hmm. to Politically Reactive. Of those two experiences, which one would you rather not do again?
Well, I mean, I would rather not be a prisoner because,
okay.
Well, I mean, it's a hard question to answer because I think, you know, this experience is really different because I had a choice about it and I could leave at any time. And I would never say that being a guard is worse than being a prisoner. But at the same time, this prison in Louisiana was way more violent than the prison that I was in Iran. It was way more chaotic. So if I had to choose between being a prisoner in either of those places, I don't know which one I would choose.
I think that says a lot. That says a lot that you're like, that's a hard question. Yeah. I think that answers it. That's all the answer we need, the fact that it's not clear. Yeah. Well, thank you, Shane, for coming today.
Thanks a lot.
Hurry, do you want to say thank you to him?
Thank you, Shane. Hey, stay safe.
I'm sort of raising him a little bit. I'm sort of his stepdad. So, Hari, what did we learn from talking to Shane Bauer from Mother Jones Magazine about prison?
We learned that anyone can be a prison guard. It is not that hard.
Anyone.
If you have the internet, you can be a prison guard.
It's funny, either that they didn't Google Mother Jones or that they did and didn't care. Like, they're like, oh, man, he really hates the prison industrial complex. But his employer does say he comes on time, so we'll have him anyway. I learned that Shane is a very well-spoken and entertaining guy for a dude who's been through two of the worst things I could think of anybody going through.
And I learned, after the interview was complete, that he's a Hari Kondabolu fan.
Yeah, I didn't want to tell you that before because I knew it would affect the interview. You just ask about what his favorite jokes you had told were and which of the clips you have on YouTube has he shared the most. That's why I wanted to say that to the end.
I like to think that, you know, in those terrible days in that Iranian prison, and also when he returned home from being a prison guard, that he listened to my comedy and it gave him some joy.
That he was just like, as he was in the Iranian prison or in his worst days at the prison in Louisiana, he was just in his head going over your feminist dick joke over and over just to make his day a little lighter.
Right, and then people were like, what are you laughing at? I'm like, oh, there's this Larry the Cable Guy joke that I just can't get out of my head. It's so good.
Well, that's going to do it for today's show. You can expect a new episode every week through the election. So if you haven't done so already, hit that subscribe button on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, whatever you use. And if you really like us, come see me or Hari do a show. If you live near Pittsburgh, come check out my show, The W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in About an Hour on July 8th. And Hari has a new album, Mainstream American Comic. It's out now on Kill Rockstars. So go pick it up, stream it, Snapchat it, whatever the kids do. Politically Reactive is a production of First Look Media and distributed by Panoply. The team includes Nick Bornstein, Lisa Linegang, Erica Mu, and Max Jacobs. This show is engineered by Ted Muldoon. Thanks to Shane Bauer and his amazing story that he wrote for Mother Jones Magazine. You should really, really check it out. And thanks to Northgate Studios here in Berkeley and Argo Studios in New York. And thanks to Brontez Purnell for providing the music for the show. All right, Hari, I'm going to take a picture with him, and then we'll get back and finish this up.
Okay.
So you can go to the bathroom if you need to.
Okay.
But don't do number one, not number two.